Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. This is a recording from the monthly Oldie Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club. To book a ticket, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk/lunches.
Our next speaker is Jane Sturton, who was an old master's specialist and then became chairman of Sotheby's, and then has had a distinguished career as a writer. He's written Great Houses of London and the British Art Collectors, and he was the biographer of Kenneth Clarke, and his latest book is Rogues and Scholars, Boom and Bust in the London Art Market, 1945 to 2000. He's also very tall, so I'm going to raise the lectern. Ladies and gentlemen, Jane Sturton.
Thank you very much indeed. First of all, Harry and Amelia, thank you for this wonderful lunch. Splendid in every way. It reminds me, actually, takes me back to my art world days. The art world loved a good lunch long after it became unfashionable in the city. And I remember my dear colleague Dick Kingsett at Agnews always used to say that whereas a cognac might mitigate against the productive afternoon, a Calvados never did. The most entertaining was done in the boardrooms of Sotheby's and Christie's. It was schmoozing clients, a bit like today, actually. And Christie's, oddly enough, they were very much posher than Sotheby's Christie's, and they didn't entertain dealers to lunch until 1974, when the very grand head of the Christie's Old Master Department, Patrick Lindsay, decided rather liberally that he'd have some dealers to lunch. And he found two dealers who had nice table manners. He found David Somerset, later Beaufort, and Anthony Spielman. Anyway, at lunch, Patrick expiated on, in a rather baleful way, about his rather negative views about the trade. And as they came out, David turned to Anthony and said, "Now I know what it feels like to be the keeper invited up to the big house." The spine of my story is very much Sotheby's and Christie's and their pursuit of world domination from the late 1950s onwards through the 1960s. In those days, both firms had chairmen who were Old Etonian, both called Peter. Peter Wilson of Sotheby's really was the genius who created international auctioneering and made London the dominant world city. His opposite number, Peter Chance at Christie's, was a more staid figure who always said about Wilson, "The man is an absolute swine," whereas Wilson would say, "Leave nothing to chance." There used to be an old joke in the art world that when a collector died, Peter Chance went to the funeral and Peter Wilson went to the house. It was true. But part of the fun of the art world was the massive pyramid, I mean, all the way down from the sort of the grandees, through the kind of Bond Street dealers, through the ancillary dealers in King's Road or Kensington Church Street, Kensington High Street, to the runners, usually came from Brighton. And then at the bottom of the pack were the knockers. Remember Parson's Pleasure, that story by Roald Dahl. So it was a marvellous sort of mélange of personalities, the art world. A lot of it wasn't very polite. I mean, there was one marvellous Cockney furniture dealer in Pimlico Road, very, very talented, called John Hobbs, later done, I'm afraid, for forgery, like the best of them. But John was never minced his words, and Elton John was a clown, and one day he took an Italian in there, and they looked at a few things, and that afternoon the Italian sent John Hobbs a fax with some rather low offers on the furniture he'd seen, to which John Hobbs sent a fax back saying, "Piss off, you cheap Italian cunt." Which Gianni Versace, for he was he, was so amused, he framed the fax and bought the furniture. What the art world liked best was a good sleeper. That was an unrecognised picture at auction. And there was a marvellous man called Monty Bernard who would sort of put his thumbs in his waistcoat pocket and say, "Well, my boy, if that's a Thomas Gainsborough, my cock's a kipper. Monty one day found, this is back in the early 60s, he found what he thought was a sleeper in a house sale in Somerset, a place called Chew Magna. And he thought it was a Corot landscape, and he got very excited. But imagine when he got on the train, and then he saw the entire art world in the restaurant car playing poker. They'd all seen it, inevitably. So anyway, undeterred, when they got to Bristol, when they had to change trains, Monty disappeared. He bribed the engine driver. So as they the second train went whistling past to Magna, and they pulled the thing to stop, stop, to no avail. The cry went up, where's Monty? Well, eventually this train did come to a stop at about three stations down, and all the taxis had mysteriously disappeared. Finally, they got to the sale. The Corot had been sold and Monty disappeared. One of the key stories of the book is the change from London as the world centre of old master sales to becoming a contemporary art city, which is very, very, very surprising in some ways. And that foundation was built back in the 60s by a very pioneering gallery, the Marlborough Gallery. And it was run by two Austrian refugees, Harry Fisher and Frank Lloyd. And they met, like so many of the refugee dealers did, in the Pioneer Corps at the end of the war. And they ran their first business. It was a donut business. They'd buy donuts in the village and they'd sell them in the camp at night when they were famished. And anyway, one day, Harry got very depressed in this land where nobody read Goethe or played Bach, and he put his head on a railway line. And Frank found him and said, Harry, Harry, what are you doing? It's Sunday, there's no trains till Thursday. Anyway, he gave up and they became the most successful art dealers in Europe instead. And they really lead a path to this extraordinary transformation of London. At the end of my time in the art market, where London, just at the moment when London might have been losing interest as the great sales were going to New York, it was saved really by the fact that London had the artists that all the collectors wanted, Damien Hirst and all the young British artists, and Damien Hirst's shark became sort of, you know, in a sense symbolic of this. Anyway, it's a rollicking tale, as you can see. More rogues, I'm afraid, than scholars. But all of life is there, and, you know, every possible kind of roguery. You know, there's looting, fraud, price fixing, auction rings, illegal export, extortion. It's all there. So thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
You have been listening to Radio Aldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get three trial issues of the Aldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every six issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter old trial.